Well, good afternoon. My name is Ray Randolph. I'm a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and I am the moderator of this conference on President Obama's January 18th Executive Order 13563 regarding regulatory review. I'm not going to say anything about the topic except to introduce our distinguished panel members, and I'll introduce them now in the order in which they'll speak, and they'll speak for 7-8 minutes each, and then have whatever comments on each other's presentation they have, and then we'll open it up to questions from the audience. Our first speaker is the Honorable Ronald Cass. He's the former dean of the Boston University Law School, and he's president now of Cass and Associates. Ron is well known to many of you in the audience. He was a former commissioner and vice chairman of the United States Trade Commission. He's written widely. He's taught administrative law and other subjects at the University of Virginia, Boston, and elsewhere. And he is chairman of the Federalist Society Administrative Law and Regulation Project. Our next speaker is Professor Sally Katzen. She's currently a visiting professor at NYU. She's taught at George Washington, University of Michigan, University of Pennsylvania, George Mason, and elsewhere. Sally served from 1999 to 2001 as Deputy Director for Management at the Office of Management and Budget, and so is quite familiar with the subject that we're going to have discussed today. Our third speaker is Donald Elliott. He's a professor at the Yale Law School, and also a practitioner here in Washington, commutes to Yale to teach 2 days a week. He's a partner at Wilkie Farr and Gallagher. He heads the environmental health and safety practice of the firm. He's been a member of the Yale faculty since 1981. He's written widely on administrative law subjects, and particularly with a concentration, I think it's fair to say, on the EPA. Jeff Lubbers is a professor of practice administrative law at American University. He, too, has been very active in ACUS, the Administrative Conference of the United States, which has been revived fairly recently. I'm forever in his debt because he published, I think, maybe the first big, thick administrative handbook with the APA in it, and then the Bible, the Attorney General's report on the APA and the Freedom of Information Act, and so on and so forth. I've used that many, many times, and I really appreciate it. And Jeff has been a consultant to various federal agencies, the World Bank. He's taught in various law schools, Georgetown and Melbourne and Ottawa and Japan and so on and so forth. And so with that, I'm going to turn to our first speaker, Ron Cass. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Judge. I appreciate the introduction, and nice to see everybody here. It's always nice addressing an audience that knows more about the topic than you do. I'm going to start by relating a brief story from Boston. Many of you know Boston as a city which the Federalist Society likes to think of as a one-party town. It is not. It is a two-party town, has both Democrats and Communists. So it's very, very important. And it's got a rich history of politics there. Mayor Curley, who was a very famous mayor of Chicago at one point, was talking to a contractor, a building contractor, who knew that the mayor was doing some renovations on his home. And the contractor came in and said, "Mayor Curley, I'm going to surprise you. I'm going to offer to do all of the renovations on your house free of charge." And the mayor said, that's an absolute surprise. I've been taking bids for 3 weeks, and that's the highest one yet. Now, this does relate to our topic, because in government, as elsewhere, there's both politics and political imperatives, and then there's sort of ordinary analysis. And what we're talking about today is trying to blend the two When the APA was passed initially, when it was designed, written, and passed, it was designed not to take politics out of government, but to try to get the processes by which government made decisions to be ones that were fairly regularized, that were set up in ways that gave people advance notice of what was going to happen, that operated in fair ways, and that so far as you could in a political domain, tried to get the quality of decision-making to be better. It's a modest set of goals, and it's probably about the right set of goals to have for government. Over time, government has expanded a bit. Regulation has grown a bit. We started out with a fairly modest set of things that were being regulated under the APA framework. We now have a Code of Federal Regulations, which is contained in more than 220 volumes and runs to more than 160,000 pages. You know that with that much written, it's got to be a little bit counterintuitive. I mean, after all, the Ten Commandments, you know, you got 10 little things there. They come down on a couple of tablets. I understand there were 15 to begin with, but one got dropped. And Moses, when he came down, said, I've got good news and bad news. We're down to 10, but adultery is still in. In any event, when you have basic rules, they are rules that are understandable because they're intuitive. Federal regulation is not like that. So over time, we've had a whole series of things that the government has been asked to do. And as it's gone about it, we've tried to improve the decision-making by adding mandates for what it considers. And Congress has done that repeatedly. It did it with NEPA. It did it with the Paperwork Reduction Act, with the Regulatory Flexibility Act, Regulatory Negotiation, Unfunded Mandate Reform. It's had a whole series of things that it's done telling the agencies what to do. The executive branch has tried to get a hold of this and tried to make sure that the decisions are less political in spots, that are more grounded in analysis in ways that seem to balance the different considerations that if you were standing above the agencies you would want them to do. And it's done that under both Republican and Democrat administrations, mostly with the same set of tools. You know, if you go back to some of the initial steps that were taken in the Carter administration and then the Reagan administration with the Order 12291, the Clinton administration with Executive Order 12866, the George W. Bush administration, and now the Obama administration, you see a series of directives to the agencies on how to go about making decisions that do change a bit. The Clinton administration adds a little bit of qualitative consideration. George W. Bush adds guidance documents in explicitly as things to be looked at along with rules. The new executive order from President Obama, again, it's not that it is a break with the past. It adds things to it. It says we should be sensitive to the costs of regulation as well as the benefits. We ought to be sensitive to what it does to business. We ought to look at how it affects our competitiveness. And all those things are sensible. It also says that in addition to all the other things you ought to think about in balancing costs and benefits, you ought to take account of things that aren't easily quantifiable. And it's hard to argue with that. And it adds a list of things that says, to the extent you can, you ought to take a look at the impact of regulation on equity, human dignity, fairness, and distributive impacts. And I think anybody can say those are all reasonable things to look at. I think the problem you get to after you have had one executive order after another layering on additional concerns and considerations for the government to look at is that you have a set of directions that are so all-encompassing, it's very hard to know what to do with it. I said in another forum at one point that what you have when you work through all these considerations is a set of things that in some sense is everything you'd want to know about decision-making and nothing in terms of directing you toward a decision. If you want to line up a group of people outside an auditorium, you can line them up in alphabetical order. You can line them up by height. You can line them up by age. You can line them up by the order in which they arrive, first come in first position. But I defy anybody to tell me how you would line them up if you're taking all those things into account. If you want to consider age, height, order of arrival and so on. So what the executive order is really trying to do is not to force a decision on agencies. It's to tell agencies, be sensitive to these things, be careful about your analysis, try to work through your problems in ways that are sensible. And it does very little more. That means that anybody who applauds this because they think it will bring about decisions they like is probably going to be disappointed. And anybody who opposes it because they think it will force decisions they don't like will probably be disappointed as well. When you get back to decisions like the contractor was facing with Mayor Curley, at the bottom line, there's a set of political imperatives and constraints that probably dominate anything we or the executive orders are going to tell them about what to do. But that said, I think it is worth keeping on the process of going back to people and saying, be careful what you do, think about it, and make sure you have considered everything in the right way. Thank you.
Thank you, and it's lovely to be here. I want to take a few steps back with a slightly different emphasis, and I would start my own participation with the Obama transition effort, where I was responsible for the executive office of the president and all the government-wide agencies. This was the agency review piece of the Obama transition. One of the responsibilities that we had was to look at all of the executive orders that had been signed by President George W. Bush and evaluate which of those had already sunsetted by their own terms, which of those were desirable and should be continued, and which of those should be modified. And one of the ones on which there seemed to have been an enormous amount of passion was 13422, which Ron had said is the executive order that George W. Bush, in his seventh year, amended the Clinton executive order, the 12866. Those of you who don't like numbers and are not following the NCAA basketball stuff with your brackets, I will try to call these by their generic names. But we tend, those of us who have practiced in this area for a long time, tend to use the numbers. In any event, the sense was that the George W. Bush amendments had politicized the process. And I mention that as a sort of a counterpoint to what Ron was talking about. It had made the decision-making and the process itself more political. And so it was not surprising that in the first week, January 30th, 2009, President Obama signed as one of his first executive orders an executive order rescinding the George W. Bush amendments, reverting back to the Clinton executive order. Now, what was interesting is that that same day he signed a memorandum directing OMB to come up in 120 days with recommendations for a new regulatory review executive order. There had, after all, been 16 years of experience, and we knew a lot more about regulatory tools, regulatory analysis, and the whole process of regulatory review. And OMB took an unprecedented step, which was to publish a notice in the Federal Register calling for comments on an executive order. Executive orders are usually not put out for comment. Executive orders are not discussed in public. They kind of come full-blown when the president signs them. 120 days passed, and there was no new executive order. And nothing much was happening, and this was long-awaited. But there were some changes. After Kaius Sunstein, who is my successor as administrator of OIRA, was finally confirmed, and that's another subject for a program for you all, is to think about the confirmation process, because maybe somebody could do something constructive in that area. In any event, after CAS was confirmed and on the ground, we started to see a few modest changes, incorporation of behavioral economics, more openness, things like that. And that's sort of the way the first 2 years of the Obama administration went, along with a very robust regulatory agenda. And then there was an election. And elections have consequences. And one of the consequences was that the message from the business community, frustration, irritation, anger at the regulatory world came through loud and clear. And you may recall that President Obama then invited a group of CEOs to a summit at the White House, and there were four breakout sessions, one of them was directed to regulations. And the CEOs were all primed, and they went in there and they said, we need to counter the adverse effect that regulations are having on economic growth, innovation, competitiveness, and job creation. Several weeks later, we have the op-ed piece, which is on your chairs today, and the executive order of January 18th. You have those documents. You can read them for yourself. But what I think is significant is that the very first sentence of the executive order, after the under the authority of, is his statement that our regulatory system must protect public health, welfare, and safety, and our environment while promoting economic growth, innovation, competitiveness, job creation. Interesting choice of words. They were taken right from the CEO's statements. It's also significant when you read the EO that as he reaffirms the Clinton executive order, he calls out and highlights what I would call the cost principles of the underlying executive order, that the benefits must justify the costs, the regs should be tailored to impose the least burden on society, taking into account the cumulative costs of regulation, that in choosing among alternative regulatory approaches, the agencies should choose that approach which maximizes net benefits. This is heavy-duty emphasis on the cost side of the equation. Now, there's also a section on integration and innovation that calls for greater coordination and harmonization among agencies. And there's a section calling for a retrospective analysis, that is a look back on the existing stock of regulations to see those which are outmoded, excessively burdensome, or otherwise in need of modification or elimination. I think one of the other panelists is going to pick up on this point. And I should mention that January 18th was a very busy day because not only was there an op-ed piece and an executive order, but there were two accompanying memoranda, one of which specifically directed to regulatory flexibility, small businesses, and job creation. In all of these papers, there isn't a whole lot of new stuff. I think the significance is that he said it at all, and that he was emphasizing, as I said, the cost side of the equation. I think the most noteworthy, however, is that in the various presidential statements, President Obama reaffirmed the role of OIRA, the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. And this is not just a parochial view of a former administrator of OIRA. I think OIRA is generally viewed in the world as providing a second opinion, quality control, some restraint on the agencies, and for presiding over the interagency process that produces sensible input from other viewpoints. And the effect of the president's reaffirming OIRA's role, as set out in 12866, I think cannot be overstated. It is an extremely strong signal to the White House and the White House people. It is an extremely strong signal to the regulatory agencies. He has, with a stroke of the pen, newly empowered OIRA, and that is particularly significant in this White House. Now, the business community was generally pleased with these documents and, for the most part, applauded the president, though it's fair to say they were waiting to see whether his agencies would match his words. Now, there have been a few moves that have been well received. There was the withdrawing of the proposed rule on noise from OSHA, the tailoring of the Boiler MAC rule, and the delay in the scheduling of the NAAQS rules. Now, for those of you who don't know MACs and NAAQS and OSHA and whatever, I envy you. someday I will get a life outside of this regulatory process. But there have been accommodations, if not wholesale reconsideration of certain activities. Has this been enough to satisfy the business community? No, not yet. I think he's moving in the right direction, but there is not enough evidence to suggest that it's meaningful, sufficiently significant, or really what they want to have happen. It certainly is not enough for the Hill. We have seen that the initial reaction to the president's efforts was restrained praise, but both before and after, there has been a lot of activity from Chairman Issa's calling for suggestions of regs that should be eliminated, to the introduction and I suppose soon to be passed the RAINS Act, and all of the substantive provisions that were attached to the continuing resolution for fiscal year 2011. This is something I hope we can talk about during the Q's and A's, because I think the interrelationship between the Hill and the White House is something truly worth watching in the next year and a half. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I agree with Ron Cass that one of the central mysteries of administrative law is how we forge together the political and the expertise side. And I want to talk about the executive order primarily from the standpoint of political rhetoric. It is, after all, fundamentally a reaffirmation of the principles in the executive order that Sally Katzen drafted, 12866, in 1993. But I think it's significant primarily as the first campaign promise of the 2012 presidential election. It is, after all, unusual for a president to do an op-ed to accompany an executive order, and the choice of venue, the Wall Street Journal, is also significant. It certainly is an attempt to reassure the business community that the Obama administration has been not so bad in a regulatory sense, and it comes even complete with a anti-regulatory factoid to rival Ronald Reagan's welfare Cadillac. That is that EPA until recently regulates saccharin as a hazardous waste, even though the FDA approves it to put in your coffee. There's a longer story about that maybe we can get into the Q&A. I don't think it actually illustrates over-regulation, but I do think it illustrates the failure to update regulations in the light of new scientific evidence. And so I would agree with Sally that probably the retrospective aspect is the most significant part of the executive order from a substantive standpoint. But I really want to look at it more from the standpoint of its intellectual structure. And from the standpoint of its intellectual structure, it is a political commitment to both guns and butter. That's its basic logical structure. And in the Wall Street Journal article, the president even says, this is the lesson of our history, that our economy is not a zero-sum game. So it's a matter of having your cake and eating it too. So here's some language from the executive order. Listen to this. Our regulatory system must protect public health, welfare, safety, our environment, while promoting economic growth, innovation, competitiveness, and job creation. And in addition, it must be based on the best available science, the open exchange of ideas. It must promote predictability and reduce uncertainty, use the best, most innovative, and least burdensome tools. Well, all laudable goals, but very consistent with the campaign approach from the last presidential election of running on a promise of change and hope. We also see this in the Wall Street Journal article's concluding sentence. We can make our economy stronger and more competitive while meeting our fundamental responsibilities to one another. This reminds me of the great critique of politicians by the great 1970s social critics, the rock band The Byrds, one of my favorites. And in their famous song, I Want to Grow Up to Be a Politician, they say, I want to grow up to be a politician and be the old US of A's number one man. I'll always be tough, but I'll never be scary. I want to shoot guns and butter my bread. I'll work in the towns and conservate the prairies. And then my favorite line, and you can believe the future's ahead. I'll give the young the right to vote as soon as they mature, but spare the rod and spoil the child to help them feel secure. So it's typical of politicians to some extent that they endorse both sides of every question. My favorite line was the one about the future lies ahead. I thought that could never be duplicated, but recently Vice President Biden advised us that we should seize the future with regard to green energy. Now, on the positive side, and to some extent, I felt that since this was a Federalist Society meeting, it shouldn't be entirely an Obama love fest. But on the positive side, it certainly has been true since Aristotle that virtue consists in striking the proper balance among competing goods. And it is also certainly true that regulatory investments that eliminate harms that are greater than their costs contribute rather than weaken the economy. For example, EPA estimates that the Clean Air Act has provided health benefits 40 times their costs, and certainly that does strengthen the economy. But that's not true for everything. There's a famous Spanish wind study of wind power in Spain that concludes that 2.5 jobs are lost for every green job that's created. What is unusual, I think, about this executive order is it's more directed to the public than to the management of the executive branch. It really is a political document. Now, having said that, I do agree with Sally Katzen that it does have some significant effects on the executive branch. Perhaps this is a place to quote one of my favorite lines from Felix Frankfurter from Universal Camera. It communicates a mood rather than a rule. So I do think that it is significant that the president said it, and that basically he is sending a signal not only to the external public but to the executive branch to be somewhat more sensitive to economic and particularly job considerations. I remember when I served as general counsel of EPA in the first Bush administration that one of the White House advisors who'd carried over from the Reagan administration said to me one time, you know, in the Reagan administration, we knew what we were for, or probably more appropriately, he should have said, we knew what we were against. But here, we have to wait until it goes up to the top to strike an ad hoc balance. I think that's true in all moderate administrations, and I do think that the Obama administration has been relatively moderate on the regulatory front. I think a lot of that is attributable to Cass Sunstein in the White House. But I think the most important thing that takes place from this executive order is the president is communicating not just to the public, but to those in his administration, that he wants not only to be tough on regulations, but to pay more attention to jobs and the economy and to strike a balance. And I also agree with Sally that we've seen actions in terms of delaying greenhouse gas reporting and the Boiler Max standard, at least until after the next election.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Judge Randolph, for your nice introduction. You and my colleagues on the panel are among the wisest and most knowledgeable lawyers in Washington, so I'm very happy to be included. And only Don could quote Roger McGuinn and Felix Frankfurter in the same speech. Now, I was going to begin my talk by quoting the famous quip I once heard attributed to Jeremy Bentham. Don't talk to me of reform. Things are bad enough as they are. But that's a little too cynical. So instead, I'll begin with a quote from the well-known Vermont Yankee decision of the Supreme Court in 1978. Not because spent fuel rods are unfortunately in the news again these days, but because Justice Rehnquist began his opinion by himself quoting a 1950 opinion of Justice Jackson, in which he described the APA as, quote, a legislative enactment which settled long-continued and hard-fought contentions and enacts a formula upon which opposing social and political forces have come to rest. I would submit that that also applies to Executive Order 12866, or the Katzen Order, as we like to call it up here. It, too, has settled long, continued, and hard-fought contentions and has enacted a formula upon which opposing social and political forces have come to rest. That's why, although I agree that Executive Order 13563 is little more than a reaffirmation of the Clinton order, it was not only a sensible political move, it was also appropriate on the merits. Politically, it made sense because revising the Clinton order to make it stronger or weaker would have only served to antagonize one side or another. And I think that Obama must have concluded rightly that that wasn't worth doing, because if the Clinton order worked for both Clinton and George W. Bush, it could work for him too. On the merits, I think that all the participants in the White House review process are used to it now. It seems to be working transparently and well. The new order does add some appropriate emphasis on different things like job creation, competitiveness, predictability, innovation, distributional effects, and flexibility. And it also does add a new requirement that agencies consult with significant stakeholders even before they issue the notice of proposed rulemaking. But basically, it reaffirms 12866 as a sound basis for going forward. I would say the same thing, by the way, about the APA, too. There are tweaks I'd like to make, but basically, I think it's a flexible and adaptable document that has well served as sort of the constitution for administrative law. Now, I know that there are probably many in this audience who may be less sanguine and who feel that we are in a period of overregulation that is damaging to our economy. But I would like to provide a few data points that I think cast doubt on that assumption. And I rely first on the report by the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is a free market-oriented NGO, that has been collecting statistics on rulemaking for some time in a useful publication called 10,000 Commandments, which I recommend to you. Its 2010 edition shows that the number of proposed rules published in the Federal Register in 2009, which, by the way, was 3,502, was 62% fewer than in 1980. The number of final rules was 55% fewer than 1980. And even compared to the number issued by the Reagan administration in 1983, there were 46% fewer proposed rules and 43% fewer final rules. In fact, the 2009 figures were the lowest in the 33 years that CEI has been collecting these statistics, and the trend line has been pretty consistently down since 1980. It also reports significantly lower number of rules having a significant impact on small businesses and on state and local governments. So I think it's sort of a myth that there's more rulemaking going on than there was in the past. Indeed, this should not be surprising. As many academics have written, notice and comment rulemaking has become a lot more difficult for the agencies, with many new analytical and procedural requirements added by the presidents, Congress, and the courts. I believe Don himself coined the term ossification of rulemaking to describe the situation. Moreover, agency resources and staffing are strained. It's not usually recognized that total executive branch employment today and for most of the past decade has been at levels of the Eisenhower administration. More to the point, key protective health and safety regulatory agencies such as EPA, NHTSA, OSHA, and the CPSC have seen their staffing and their budgets, adjusted for inflation, flatline in the last 40 years, and further cuts are being sought. Just to give one example, the ratio of federal OSHA inspectors to federally protected workers has gone from 1 to 30,000 in the late 70s to 1 to 60,000 today. Other consumer and labor protection agencies such as the CFTC, EEOC, FCC, FTC, NLRB, and NRC have shown little, if any, growth in staffing in the last 20 years. Now, I realize that just counting the number of rules is a pretty rough proxy for regulatory burdens, and some rules are more burdensome than others. So what about the costs and benefits of major rules? Well, here we have the benefit of OMB's annual report to Congress on the aggregate costs and benefits of the major rules they have reviewed each year. According to OMB's 2008 report to Congress, issued at the end of the Bush administration, the estimated benefits of the major regulations reviewed by OMB from 1992 to 2007 exceeded the estimated costs by more than fourfold. More specifically, for the decade from 97 to 2007, the estimate of total annual benefits ranged from $122 billion to $656 billion, while the estimated annual costs range from $46 to $54 billion. So the cumulative net benefits range from $68 billion to $610 billion. So therefore, the major rules, the ones with the most impact on the economy, have had a net beneficial impact. Does that mean there's nothing to be concerned about? Not at all. There are several issues obscured by these factoids. One is that agencies likely have increased their improper use of binding guidance as a substitute for rulemaking, as rulemaking has become more difficult. The courts have awakened to this problem and have been tougher on this in recent years, led by Judge Randolph. And OMB's Good Guidance Bulletin, which relies heavily on several administrative conference recommendations, provides an excellent set of ground rules for agencies' use of guidance. I agree that this type of underground rulemaking leads to unpredictability, and it needs to be policed in such a way that useful guidance is not chilled. But I am also afraid that as long as regular rulemaking remains ossified, agencies will continue to evade it and engage in more underground or shadow regulation. And finally, there is the problem of cumulative burden. Even though there is less rulemaking now, and even if the rules that do make it through the gantlet are cost-beneficial when they're issued, there is a need to reassess rules periodically and review the body of existing regulations to eliminate outdated, duplicative, and unnecessary regulations. This also applies to guidance. This is not a new problem. In fact, the first President Bush, mandated a top-to-bottom review of existing regulations in 1992. I happened to be in the White House auditorium at the time this was announced. And the administration official, I forget his name at the time, gave the analogy that it was like going into your clothes closet and looking at all the clothes that you have not worn in the past year. You're not likely to wear them in the next year either, so you should get rid of them. For some reason, that stuck with me, mainly because I have some bell bottoms in my closet. But President Clinton institutionalized this in Executive Order 12866, and that order, still in effect, requires agencies to review existing regulations to ensure that they are still timely, compatible, effective, and do not impose unnecessary burdens. In 1995, he announced that as a result of his initiative, about 12,000 pages of the Code of Federal Regulations were eliminated, and another 15,500 were reinvented. But in the Bush II administration, OIRA regularly solicited nominations of rules that should be reviewed for ineffectiveness or inefficiency. Now, here's where the Obama EO takes a strong position. The agencies were given 4 months to submit a plan to OMB describing how they will periodically review their existing regulations to make them less burdensome or more effective. The problem is that this has not been an easy task for agencies to do. And I'm going to quote Sally here. She wrote in 1994 about the Clinton initiative, "It was more difficult to institute than we had anticipated. Agencies are focused on meeting the obligations for new rules, often under statutory or court deadlines, at a time when staff and budgets are being reduced. Under these circumstances, it is hard to muster resources for the generally thankless task of rethinking and rewriting current regulatory programs." In 1995, the Administrative Conference studied this and supported the idea that agencies do have an obligation to develop systematic processes for reviewing existing rules on an ongoing basis. ACUS did, however, caution that given the difference among agencies, processes for reviewing agency existing regulations should not be a one-size-fits-all mandate. It should be tailored to meet agencies' individual needs. In fact, one problem with an across-the-board cut is that it penalizes agencies that have already done a good job in reducing overlapping and unnecessary regulations. This creates the perverse incentive for agencies to leave their outdated regulations on the books until the next administration initiative comes down that says, please cut your rules by 10%. So I think it would be better for the review to focus on the most important regulations, the ones with the highest burdens on the economy or the lowest net benefits. We should also make sure that the agencies have sufficient time and resources to ensure meaningful analysis and consult the public for its view. In sum, I think the Obama order is an appropriate incremental reform, and I'll leave my Benthamite observations on some of the proposals that have been floated lately for the discussion period, which I look forward to. Thank you.
I think we'll take questions now from the audience. Yes, sir.
I have a very different perspective on what you said.
Wait, one minute.
Will you identify
yourself, please?
Yes, I'm Edward Sigel, and I'm going to identify briefly the perspective so you can say why you disagree with. I come from a systems analysis perspective. I have 20 plus years of experience with the government, and I was hired in the Nixon administration to review all the operations of the federal government and the implications of the economic policies. And in my experience, everybody tries to write good rules. The whole memo of Obama, I would say, it says write good rules, write proper rules. The rest of the stuff, I mean, who wants to write stupid rules? Who wants to be inefficient and ineffective, too costly? It's like when we say eat healthy foods with moderation. I mean, who wants to die? And so, and we have lots of these rules, you know, the win inflation now, the fight the drugs, the wars and here and there. I've been in all this stuff. And the major problem is in implementation. It's not from the legal perspective. The rules are usually well written. The implementation, I find it horrend. It's terrible. It's very incompetent. The computer systems in the federal government are very poorly written and inefficient. And there's not an exhaustive list of issues, an exclusive list of issues, a proper assignment of responsibilities. So my point is that there's too much emphasis being placed on how you write the rules, and not enough is placed on how the rules are actually implemented in practice, and what does it mean, and fixing the problem of competence in implementing the rules, not the problem of cutting more or less rules, because really you can put two rules together, so now you have 50% reduction.
I want to summarize your question, okay? There's a poem that always stuck with me, and I finally discovered its source, and I'll give it to you. Show me not the end without the way, for ends and means on earth are so entangled that changing one, you change the other two. Each different path brings other ends in view. That's your question. It was by Ferdinand de La Salle, and I would have quoted it in an opinion until my law clerk told me that he was a Nazi socialist. So I... That's redundant.
Was your law clerk or the poet?
Ferdinand.
I'd like to try. I'll try to answer the first question because I didn't think I really got the second restatement of it. But I don't disagree with what you say at all. I think, and maybe that's all because I also come from a systems perspective. I think the problem is much more an issue of evaluating how rules are working than the number of rules or the production process. And one of the things that certainly I think all of us who've written about the OMB review process have criticized is it focuses too much on the front end and you know the promulgation of new rules. What's missing from our system, and I finally found a place where they, I think, do it in a way that we could learn from, and that is in Taiwan, where they have the original Chinese constitution of 1927 from Sun Yat-sen. They have five branches of government, and one of the branches of government is an independent evaluation branch. And their sole function, it's a little bit like our GAO, but on a more systematic basis, is to continually be evaluating how the various agency rules are actually working in practice and making recommendations for what can be streamlined or eliminated or whatever. And I think having been at an agency where, you know, you always have, from a political standpoint, because of the nature of the Congress, you know, more deadlines and more new rules than you can possibly ever get out, I think agencies are the wrong place to locate the task of evaluating the performance of their own rules and making. We do in many of the states have legislative revision commissions which study the laws. The ALI performs this kind of function in a lot of common law areas, reviewing how things are. So I think what's missing from our system is a systematic part of the government that would look at this, and I think it's a mistake to give it to agencies to review their own. I mean, it's better than nothing. It's better than ignoring it, but I think structurally, we do. It is a missing part of our system. So I agree with you.
Did you have something?
Well, I was just going to say that, I agree that we have to look at implementation as well, and there are ways of doing that. And I'm skeptical about general instructions making big changes in rules. I don't think it's wrong to say that instructions have some impact. You know, when you tell regulators that they need to look at certain things. It won't change the fundamental framework they work in, but it can have a ripple effect in terms of how the people in the agency draft the rule, how the people at the top of the agency review it, how people in the White House look at it, what the conversations are among people in government. So as skeptical as I am about big changes, I don't think it is a lost project to have some look at this, and I think the extent to which we can do it in a way that emphasizes there are costs to rules, there are concerns about them, is positive, since often the forces that are most active in the agency, whether they're business forces or forces opposed to business or particular sides of either one of those, tend to be forces that have a strong focus on only one aspect of what you would like the agency to consider.
I would pick up on one other piece of this without disagreeing with what my two colleagues have said so far, and that is his emphasis on the state of the computer systems within the government, the failure to enforce things. Remember what Jeff said about the amount of money going to the regulatory agencies. We have a true schizophrenia in this country, whether it's between the political parties or within the government. We want a small government, so how could we possibly have another agency looking at these things? Can you imagine creating a fifth branch of the government when you want to have a small government? We want to have less spending, so the first place we go to are the federal employees, freeze their wages. The second thing that we go to is cut back on the budgets of these agencies. What happens when you cut back on the budgets of these agencies? There are consequences. And what happens, inevitably, is that without the resources, they don't do as good a job as they otherwise could do. But you can't have your cake and eat it. You can't have an extremely efficient, effective, smart government while it's either being strangled in the tub or otherwise left to hang out to dry. I think I've just mangled that metaphor completely. I'll stop now.
Jeff? I just want to make a smaller point related to implementation. When agencies issue significant rules with economic impacts, they have to do a cost-benefit analysis. And typically, I think it's pretty widely assumed that the business community exaggerates the costs and the environmental community, to take EPA, exaggerates the benefits. It almost becomes an adversarial thing in producing these cost-benefit analyses. So I'd like to see some retrospective looks 10 years after to see what the true costs and benefits actually were, which then might become a feedback loop to doing better cost-benefit analysis in ensuing rules. But of course, that takes resources as well. It's difficult to do.
Is anybody else? Jane?
I'm Gene Scalia with the Gibson Dunn Law Firm. I've often wondered whether the OIRA process that administers executive orders of this nature doesn't actually have the effect of making it harder for a president to accomplish his agenda. Executive orders, as I think a couple of you have said, perform an important rhetorical function, both toward the public and the part of the president and his administration, and then also, to some extent, maybe providing discipline and guidance to folks in the agency, and also it's a tool that people going before the agencies can use to argue for what they want. But what I have found in being in the government is it just makes it a much longer process to get a rule done. And administrations, once you particularly consider the amount of time to staff up, the delays caused by midterm elections, and then the new campaign much later, time is about the most precious thing you have. So it seems to me a much better model for a president is getting the right people in the cabinet agencies, telling them to do a good job and run with it, and have neither the slowdown you get at the White House from OIRA review, nor arguably the political liability that attaches to the president when his own office reviewed and approved a rule, rather than his being able to say, well, that was done by these experts over at the Labor Department, that was their decision, and I defer to it.
I would very much disagree with that, Gene.
And I meant to add, with all respect for the people who've administered the important office of OIRA.
Right, and not taking that personally at all. I think it's essential. Agencies are set up with statutory mandates, and they focus, as they should, on what they were set up to do. It is a one-dimensional focus. But we don't have one-dimensional problems. And actions taken by EPA will have an effect on DOT. Actions taken by DOL will have an effect on DOE. And if you do not have the perspective of other agencies and other departments in the executive branch, you get a one-dimensional look at the problem. It may come out faster. I do not think it would be better. And this was a conversation we had at the lunch table. People talk about OIRA and talk about cost-benefit analysis, and let's debate the merits of whether it's a level playing field and all that kind of stuff. But I think the real value of the OIRA process is the interagency process that OIRA presides over, so that when EPA issues a proposal, DOT will comment on it, the Treasury will comment on it, maybe even the Defense Department will comment on it in-house before it goes out. And you were, with all respect, at the Labor Department, and I would say that among the most proficient, aggressive regulators, DOL might be at the very bottom. We kept having trouble getting them to send us a rule so we could expeditiously get it out. OSHA has its own problems in that regard, which have been through Republican and Democratic administrations. This is bipartisan criticism, not one-sided. But in terms of the ability to have the different perspectives, I think you must have that. And they are the eyes and the ears of the president. They're closest to the president, both physically, psychologically, than even if you had the very best people, most trusted scouts in all the agencies.
I'd like to address that, too, from the other side. And I generally agree with Sally. My experience has been being regulated by OIRA. I was the primary liaison between EPA and OIRA. And I do think that OIRA has greatly improved the process and has greatly improved the ability of presidents to control the process. And if you read the memoirs of people, I think that's rather clear. But you do have an excellent point, Gene, in the sense that a lot of this depends on how close the OIRA administrator is to the president, and can they really speak for the president. Earlier this year, somebody told me off the record that, you know, Cass Sunstein was trying to do the right thing, but nobody else in the White House was supporting him. Well, in fact, somebody else in the White House was supporting him, his old friend Barack Obama. And to the extent that an OIRA administrator really has confidence and close ties of the president and can speak for the president, people figure that out. It's not always the case. One time when I was there, you know, like a 28-year-old, you know, 3 years out of the Harvard School of Public Policy, was telling the assistant administrator for the air program what the president wanted on something, and the assistant administrator for air said, well, now, I wrote all of George Bush's environmental speeches in the last campaign. You know, what did you do? Why is it that you speak for the president? So I think this proximity to the president varies from administration to administration. But to have the system work, you really need to have an OIRA administrator who is really close to the president and can really speak for the president, knows what the president's will is. And the reason it doesn't work just by appointing good people is the information flows within the agencies. Most of the concerns that I was hearing from OIRA and interagency review were not issues that had been identified for me to decide earlier. So I really do think that oftentimes you need to have a kind of somebody playing devil's advocate so that the political people in agencies can decide the issues.
I think you're raising the costs and benefits of OIRA review in a sense here. And I, although I tend to agree with both Sally and Don in general. I do think you make a very good point with respect to the delays, because at a minimum, you're talking about a six-month delay for rules that, when they go through OIRA, both in the proposed and final stages. And if it's true that these rules that make it through OIRA have a large large positive cost-benefit ratio, then 6 months delay in getting those rules out has a cost. And I think that needs to be factored into the process, into the equation.
Yes, sir.
I'm Sam Kasner. I'm general counsel with Competitive Enterprise Institute. Professor Lubbers, I was gratified to hear you quoting from our recent report, the 10,000 Commandments. But I had not, from my reading of that report, picked up the notion that it showed a deregulatory trend. And so I emailed the author of the report to ask what he thought of that, and said, he just texted me that, quote, in numbers of rules, yes, there's been a decline. But that's because all rules have now been combined into one big, huge, giant, expletive deleted rule. But I would like to ask a question of all the panelists, and this has to do with, I guess it's, Ms. Katzen, you're pointing to the executive, to the Obama executive order, and the op-ed is indicating that these are important issues that he wants agencies to think about. I pose to you the other possibility here, the more cynical one, that these are important pieces of rhetoric that he wants agencies to mouth when they come out and do whatever it was they were going to be doing anyway. And the reason I take that view is because if you look at the examples of deregulation that he gives in his Wall Street Journal op-ed, one is this saccharine delisting rule, which EPA took about 7 years to act on. The petition to delist saccharin had been sitting at EPA for 7 years. I'm sure its decision to finally grant that petition had just about zero in the way of significant costs, and yet that's the first item he mentions. The second one is the CAFE rules, which your successor, John Graham at OIRA, had once identified as the deadliest single set of regulations in the federal government, and yet here the president is touting making those standards even more stringent, as he puts it, aggressive, as yet another example of a deregulatory maneuver that was respectful of jobs and economic costs. I mean, if those are the only things he could point to as examples of deregulation that his administration has really engaged in, what the hope for the future is there, even if it is in front of us? Thank you.
I think there's a difference between deregulation and sensitivity to these things. Let me start at the beginning of your comment rather than at the end. You are certainly entitled to your cynicism, and I respect your viewpoint on that. I don't think that that was either his motivation or his intent, and I do not think that is how the agencies heard it. These are the words to mouth when you do what you want to do anyway. I can't think of a president of the United States wasting his time on the amount of materials that were put together here and going through them personally as he did to that end. But whether another president might, I don't think this president did. So I have a different take. I believe he affirmatively, genuinely, enthusiastically wanted to send a message to the agencies, in part for his friend Cass Sunstein, to say, this is what matters to me. As to the examples that you give, I'm not on the inside. I don't know why those were chosen. But I don't think the goal was deregulation. I think the goal was sensible regulation. And I want to add one factoid to Jeff Lubbers, even though there may be some difference of interpretation on the data that he got from your excellent report. And that is, most of the regulations that are churned out month after month, year after year, in both Democratic and Republican administrations are the product of the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, Capitol Hill. And Congress does not impose upon itself any requirement to do cost-benefit analysis when it passes a law. I have seen any number of references that right now, most of you are probably thinking, of course there's all this regulation and even more coming, 143 regulations from Dodd-Frank. And my God, how many are coming out of Obamacare, or if you want to use the real name for it, the Affordable Care Act. That's what they're scared about. That's what they're nervous about, all the ones that are coming. Those were decisions made by Congress, in this instance, a Democratic Congress. The other aspect of it is the courts, with deference to the good judge. There have been any number of settlements approved by courts which have imposed deadlines, and those have completely and totally skewed the priorities of the agencies. A recent person who was at EPA, who I will not identify, said something about what was your takeaway from your time in the government? The answer is, EPA is driven by court-ordered deadlines. And when EPA went back to the district court to get an extension on the boiler MAC, they were told, no, you can't. Well, we don't want to do it now. We need to do more work on it. We need to think about it. We want to do all these other kinds of things. No. Congress said it should be out by 2001. You've spent 10 years beyond what Congress said. You've got 30 days, period. We're not going to go into contempt. No one's going to do that willingly. So if you could get Congress to think about the regulatory state in a constructive way, if you could get the courts to think about the issues, I think you might have some salutary effects.
We do think about the issues occasionally.
Ray, I have a little more sympathy for the questioner. And I don't disagree.
I didn't mean to be unsympathetic.
I don't disagree with Sally that, you know, that when presidents issue these orders, they're doing it not just for the politics of it. But, you know, like Mayor Curley, they live in a political arena. They live in a political world. Agencies live in a political world. And the politics of what is affecting the agency, the politics of the congressional committees that deal with them, that are calling them up to testify, that are sometimes making life miserable for people in the executive branch, has a lot to do with how they go about the job every day. It's not just the words on the piece of paper that is on the statute or the way it's interpreted by the court, but it's also the environment in which they're having to make decisions. And when a president says, I want you to do something this way, you take him at his word, but you also realize that he's living in a political environment, and words don't always have the same meaning to everyone. When you talk about wanting better regulation, I think everyone wants better regulation. We just disagree about what is better. And when someone tells you to think about something, sometimes that affects your behavior. Other times, you know, my doctor said to me, you should think about exercise. And I said, doctor, I have. Obviously, he meant it a little bit differently than I was taking it. But, you know, I don't think it is wrong to say that even if you want to have an impact on the way agencies do their business, you may have some political plus in your list of reasons for doing this. One last thing while I have the mic temporarily.
Yeah.
And that is, when you talk about the number of regulations and you talk about the impact of regulations, we shouldn't ignore the fact that business today operates, for the most part, in a much more competitive global market. So if our regulations impose extra costs on the business, apart from whether there are offsetting or greater social benefits, businesses are going to be more sensitive to it than they might have been 10 or 20 or 30 years ago. And I think that also is part of the political environment that we see being brought to bear on the pushback against regulation.
Okay. Jeff, do you want to?
I think you raise an interesting point about whether agencies are actually conglomerating individual rules into bigger rules. And I haven't seen any evidence of that. I think it would be worth studying. I think it's a little counterintuitive, because if agencies are trying to avoid having to do the cost-benefit analysis for a rule that exceeds $100 million of impact, they won't want to conglomerate smaller rules into a big rule that exceeds that threshold. That's point number one. Point number two is, We've had the $100 million threshold for major rules since 1978 when Jimmy Carter first used it. And we still have it today. And in 1978 dollars, that would be about $40 million. And yet, the number of economically significant rules is not that much higher today than it was, you know, than it has been over the years. So I don't think there's this huge number, huge increase in much bigger rules. Secondly, with respect to the CAFE rules, I'm not familiar with it specifically, but Ron and I were at a Mercatus Center program, in which somebody spoke about a study that they had done of the quality of cost-benefit analysis for the about, I don't know, 100 rules that have been, major rules that have been done. And I recall that he said that that was the best one in terms of their quality scale. So, you know, I think that maybe that's why President Obama singled it out.
I think that one of the difficulties with the executive order is that, is what Ron alluded to earlier, and it essentially says, consider everything and then do the right thing. So it doesn't have an awful lot of content to it. It touches so many bases that, you know, from the standpoint of the definition of information of in terms of excluding some possibilities, you know, by including everything, it doesn't have an awful lot of content, I think. The process, I think, is very important. So to me, the president's Wall Street Journal article was probably more important and more influential than the executive order itself. Because I think Sally made an excellent point that a lot of the reputation of the administration as being very pro-regulatory and aggressive is coming out of the Congress and the enactments of the Congress. And here, when you have the president saying personally, you know, pay attention to the job impacts and the economic impacts of your rules, I think that sends an important message to people in the agencies. And I know, without getting into too many specifics, that there was a time when the political appointees at some of the agencies were substantially to the left of many of the staff recommendations that were coming up. And I do think that the president sending a signal, whether it's for political reasons or it's because of the economic crisis, I mean, the motivation isn't germane for the moment, but I think that the president sending a signal, hey, we really do have to pay serious attention to the economic and innovation and job creation effects of these rules, and we have to strike a balance. I'm convinced that people in the agencies have heard that, and I think you can see that in their conduct. And I think, for example, on Boiler MACT, I think that the agency going back to the court and asking for more time for reconsideration was pretty much a direct result of this change. A couple of weeks earlier, industry was raising the same concerns, and they were essentially getting stuffed by the Obama administration. And I think when the president sends this signal, you do see a different attitude today. And again, leave aside the motivations and how long it will last, but I do think that he has communicated a mood to people in the agencies, and that's important.
Yes.
Thank you. My name is Sophie Miller, and I work with a think tank / nonprofit just across the bridge in Arlington. My question is sort of directed toward Mr. Lubbers. So I think if I caught you correctly, you're implying that the number of major rules has not really increased significantly. Is that sort of what you were saying? There aren't more economically
yes.
significant?
Yes. Well, I haven't gone back to look at the figures, and maybe they're in the 10,000 Commandments report.
Sure.
But I think because the threshold has remained the same and actually right. essentially gone down when you take into account inflation, the number of economically significant rules should have gone up quite a bit, and I'm not sure that they have.
Well, but one thing, though, of note is that using that metric alone doesn't tell you very much about the cost of the regulations because, I mean, a rule that would have $99 million in impact would not be on there, whereas something a rule with $101 million impact would be on the same grade as something that costs $10 billion in impact yearly. So I don't know if that's really an appropriate metric if you're going to try to measure the cost of rules over time to say, well, there hasn't been a dramatic increase, or however you want to say it, in the number of major regulations, because there is no, there's no real gradation. It's either one or the other, and it doesn't show you how impactful it is.
That's a fair point. And I guess if there was a rule that, you know, had, you know, $10 billion impact, you know, and it had been conglomerated with a lot of other rules, that would meet the point that was made earlier. But I just haven't seen evidence of that. And I think that so that's just with respect to counting rules. Now, with respect to the aggregate cost-benefit analysis, I'm just relying on the OMB report to Congress for that.
Can I make a brief comment on that? Sure. I think that we're missing a very important change just by looking at rules. Rules and the modern expansion of rulemaking goes back to the Nixon administration, where they called it off-budget spending. And because they were very worried about a structural deficit, they decided that rather than doing direct government spending, they would start imposing regulations on the private sector to do things rather than have the government do them directly. That flipped in the recent economic crisis. And one of the reasons we're seeing less pressure in the regulatory arena is the government is now doing it directly. So just to take one example, you know, they're borrowing the money and spending it directly rather than making regulatory requirements for the private sector to do it. So take green energy. You could increase the amount of green energy by passing a federal renewable portfolio standard, which we haven't been able to do in the Congress. But alternatively, you could build $78 billion of spending on green energy into the so-called stimulus package. And just to put that in perspective, which is what they did, put that in perspective, that's 10 times the annual EPA budget, more or less. So we can't assess the activism of the government by looking at regulation alone, because direct government spending and regulation are to some extent substitutes for one another.
And also there's guidance, which isn't reflected in these numbers of rules.
You have any comment? Okay. We're done. Okay. I think that's it. Thank you very much. It was very enlightening.
Thank you. That was fun.